Welcome to Tech at Lunch, the podcast that satisfies your hunger for all things tech while you enjoy your midday meal. So grab your sandwich, tune in, and let's dig in. Hello, I'm Nick.
Hello, I'm Ed.
Hey, I'm John.
And, you know, you kind of heard Ed Wack with us. You know, he's back from his gallivanting across.
Sabbatical.
Yeah, he has a little sabbatical year going. But, you know, just because he's been out of pocket, we're not going to grill him with all the other stuff we're working on this week. The past, you know, couple times, you know, we've been talking, you know, unless he wants to chime in on some of that stuff, then, you know, he can go ahead and do that. You know, we've kind of made mention about, you know, a couple things, here and there throughout the, you know, actually the last 2 weeks and the week before, as we started really talking about, you know, 3D scanning and stuff like that. We told y'all that we had a Revo Point, 3D scanner, Morocco, that is, or Merco, or Morocco.
I think you got it. Morocco.
Morocco, yeah, it's more of that. You know, showing up, and well, guess what? It's not sitting right here in front of me. So, you know, really, what we're going to do is we're going to kind of dive more into the 3D scanning uses, and kind of, you know, how we foresee the future use in 3D scanning. As far as when you start talking about, you know, 3D modeling and rapid prototyping and, you know, iterative design and stuff like that. You know, it's not the great buzzwords, but, you know.
I mean, it's how it's supposed to be used. It's what it's supposed to be used for. I mean, with time, we'll have a bit of experience with it. But I think the goal of technology in the first place was a lot of stuff that we didn't want to do. We wanted to kind of maybe automate or some things that we couldn't do as quickly. We have computers to do. We don't want to make those tedious tasks constantly. So we started developing ways to make it happen. I mean, this is, in my eyes, is another iteration of that. We talked about scanning and how scanners work and what are the scanners used for, that the first episode a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. But really, when you get down to brass tacks and what it can bring to the industry, this is another step up. I mean, we've had scanners for a while.
Yeah.
Not very good scanners. I'm not saying that this is the top of the line because the jury's still out.
We haven't really played with it too much.
But I like the idea. It's got the all-in-one unit. It's got a lot of the cameras. It doesn't have the USB connection to your PC that you need. For most of them.
Yeah.
So this one you can upload afterwards. I'm not sure if there's all over.
There's over the air. There's
over
OTA.
The air too. Yeah. Nice. So yeah. In that sense, though, we're also scanning is happening no matter what for a lot of the scanners, but we're getting into the nitty gritty of quality of life improvements.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is another way to get you if you're a CAD designer, you're not going to completely like throw away your CAD applications.
Oh, no.
You're still going to have to do some post processing. But this is going to be an easy way for you to get to a workable model faster.
Yeah. Your post-processing may go up just a smidgen. Your post-processing time may go up a little bit just because you're getting rid of the background noise.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and all scanners have background noise. That have to be edited out. But they're usually edited out via the scanner software before you export it to a CAD-based system. Then you can play with it from there. So, but, you know, I think that, you know, we'll see maybe an increase in time to clean it up because you got to use two applications instead of one.
Yeah.
But I think that, like you said, that the time save is there.
You're still saving time no matter what.
Yeah, and, you know, the fact that you can take that and quickly edit it, change how you need it, modify what you need, get your measurements, and then off to a printer or a CAD machine, you know, a CNC machine to actually, you know, build the parts that you need. Yeah. You know, to rapidly get, you know, things back on track.
Yeah, I think last time we talked about like a lot of the styles of the camera, how it takes the scans and things like that, with like dot matrices and LiDAR and things like that. With that comes a lot of, I guess you'd have to have some intimate knowledge with how light kind of reflects off of objects. Chromes are probably going to have tough times with a scanner. But when you talk about those situations, there's solutions also.
Oh, yeah.
Like we figure out the easiest solution for a lot of things. Like for 3D printing, we use isopropyl alcohol to break up, you know, anything that's stuck to the bed or clear off any of the oils, it dries up really fast and it's able to break up a lot of those things. So similarly with this, it's got, you can probably make, I mean, well, there was one YouTube video, I'm not suggesting you do this, but he was using dry shampoo and just spraying it on. Another channel said use baby powder mixed with isopropyl and you just put it in the spray bottle. Because that, in my eyes, that's a little bit better because it's easier to clean off. But the dry shampoo is supposed to just come right off as well. It's just, it's supposed to dry things up and take humidity out. So.
Then you have the blue bottle that they sell on Amazon, but they also sell through a German supplier. I think they're a German supplier.
Yeah.
That, you know, it just disappears over time. It's a couple hours and it goes away. And, you know, with that, they also sell it where it could be, you know, sprayed via an aerosol can. It could be sprayed via a air compressor, you know, spray gun. If you have...
Like a
low pressure LVPO. Okay. If you have large scanning areas, like if you're doing a vehicle to do like a replacement part or something like that, you can easily throw it into an LVPO gun, you know, spray it, and then you have no residue after a little bit.
Okay.
Which is actually pretty cool.
So I think that the big, if we're talking about where we're going with scanning, regardless of what technology you use, you know, where we're going with scanning is design. So right now in robotics, as for an example, we do offline programming. So what you're going to see more of, say if we said automotive, it doesn't matter if it's aftermarket or if it's actually an OEM. It's the same. There's nothing different between the two. You can take said technology, scan an IP. You scan that IP instrument panel, and that instrument panel basically can be captured. You can put that in a virtual environment. Now you can start to do design or redesign or start to do calculations on that. And from that, you basically take out the time of somebody drawing something. So the advantage of having a scanner is that it's the same thing you have with offline programming. 90% of it's done, and you do most of the finite or most of the, I would say, the optimization with the human.
Now, I'm going to jump on that real quick. Because if you think about it, you can get these 3D scanners, and you can create virtual worlds. Right, you can upload all this stuff in Blender. We were talking about the other day when you start really getting into your augmented reality side of the house. You start getting it into, you know, the headsets and stuff like that. If you put a good scanner, it doesn't have to be, you know, RevoPoint. It could be whoever at this point on the end of a robot and scan the actual area in which it is going to be worked. You can technically turn that into a 3D environment, where somebody can stand there and watch, and they can watch the robot move. And they get an idea, especially if we start getting into new installations and stuff like that. You start getting into robot, you know, into safety fence design. If you have to change how that safety fence is set up, you can use that scanner to put you into an augmented reality environment to actually show you where that safety fence should be actually located. Right.
So now the reason the safety fence is the way it is, it's not because of where the robot is.
Right.
It's because of the safe start distance. Mm-hmm. So the robot can accelerate, and if I have a safety event, it stops.
Right.
Then mechanically, there is a friction disc inside of a servo that when you stop in electromagnetics that work together to stop the robot. Depending on the life of that friction plate and the strength of that magnetic field, that will determine the velocity and the velocity, gravity, and other things from physics that will determine that stop distance. So what we do is we say we need a safe stop distance from the robot to the human.
Mm-hmm.
Worst case scenario.
Right.
So what it would do is it would give you that it would give you a visual. It would give you a visual of that area, but then you still would have to use a human to do some type of computation to verify what the distance is, how long it would take, and then worst case.
Right.
So you still would have to have mathematics in conjunctions with your environment.
Yeah, but the one thing that, you know, I think would actually be pretty cool to use it with is layout design. as far as if I have a cell in the front left of my building and I need to put one in the middle and I need to put one here, it'll help me design my walkways in between those cells for to adequately move people, you know, and machinery from one location to another, especially if you're building handover stations and stuff like that. So you can really use it to for like line optimization and stuff like that.
And once again, like you can, that can be used that way, but you still the physics still.
Oh yeah, I know that.
You still have to pay physics. I don't say it that way. Yeah. Physics always has to be paid.
Yeah. Or and it can't, like, and we just watch what happens.
So the way that you're saying is like pretty much there's a safety field inside of the scan area. So like a box inside the box, and it's maximum distance I could be if this robot came to a stop and it keeps moving, just like if you're stopping at a stoplight. Okay.
Yeah, I just trying to make sure. So basically what happens is because of gravity, because of acceleration, velocity, and things like that, what happens in the center,
there's
the
like
center,
a little bit of
the center of gravity, center of mass, those type of things.
Yeah.
When a object is in motion.
Yeah, it must stay in motion until
potential and kinetic energy, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm saying the point is a human is here. Yeah. I have to be able to stop a certain safe distance from having a collision with the human. I do not care about the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm only responsible in the eyes of OSHA for the human.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Okay. No, I was just trying to conceptualize it and just make it make sense. I mean, honestly, it's clear because, I mean, I don't want to get hit by a robot. It will not stop at us.
It will.
You can do that, and then OSHA would come knock on your door, and then maybe you'll get a really big fine.
There you go.
And they'll close the plant. So the point I was trying to make is Nick is right, but physics has to be incorporated into this augmented reality.
Yeah.
So what you're alluding to is that say I have a left-hand part, and now I need to mirror this to a right-hand part. Then all of the things that once physics has been accounted for, I can literally mirror this to the right side, as long as everything from the left side mirrors the right side.
And you know, if you start thinking about it,
makes sense.
You know, when you start really, you know, also one thing, you know, if you're really getting into like cell design and stuff like that, you know, we all watch the Titans of CNC.
Mm.
You know, it's a nerd out thing. Me and Ed usually do when we're hanging out here at the house because we're gonna watch TV. Is how they have their lines set up with all their CNC machines, and the fact that they're incorporating pick and place robots into their area of operation inside the build process,
which are actually cobots.
But the thing is if you take a 3D scan of that entire environment, you kind of see, can I move this machine here to optimize this workflow?
Yep.
Can I move this machine here to optimize this workflow? Yeah. And you have everything in cyberspace. And then you can actually, you know, move stuff around and say, okay, cool, this makes sense. This doesn't make sense. Let me put a table here. Let me put a table here because now I'm actually inside my own location.
I'll give you a perfect application of what you're talking about that would work. As long as I know the center of gravity from the axis 6. So as long as I know my TCP and my center of gravity for whatever tooling I have on there, what if I went from a application where I was picking up a door to now I need to pick up a floor.
Yeah.
Now I need to change the tooling. Instead of redesigning everything from the base plate of Axis 6, I'm already at the TCP. As long as the tooling stays in the same orientation, I can try different iterations of how I want this to transform itself from being picking up a door to picking up a floor.
Yeah, as long as your mounting surface.
But now I do have to account for the weight and the rigidity of a floor is going to be different from the rigidity of a door.
Yeah. Now, I mean, it makes sense. So AR, augmented reality, is something we talked about in one of the last episodes. I think it was the last one. But
yeah, I think it was last week.
But that was kind of the idea I was getting around whenever I'm talking about, like, if I view myself as a doctor and I put AR and I have an overlay, like, it's always nice to, like, if I'm working on something, depending on how much it distracts you, right? I would like to have some type of documentation here, maybe some proof, maybe an example. Okay, cool. Just check myself as I work. To me, the augmented reality makes me more of an efficient worker. In a lot of the situations that we're talking about, if you're talking about planning, it makes it so that you don't have to do this station 6 different times and to get it right. Like, you do it once, you scan it, then you move stuff around, you take into account your barriers, and you take into account the physics of the anything that was going to live inside that station. And at that point, you have all of your, you have everything that you need to be able to say, okay, well, theoretically, this is what it could look like. And that's the same thing I was talking about with scanning and how it combined with AR, because we're talking about a station, and we say station probably about the size, like a little bit bigger than a car, but like about 12 feet high, right? Kind of like a little box there that you're working in, just that whole area. But I was even thinking with this little scanner that you got here, like if you're making they do it with a lot of like a diorama for like a mm-hmm. neighborhood or something mm-hmm. like that. I can have a blank box to say, okay, all right, guys, every house is getting a half acre land. You're getting 1,200 square feet. Everybody's getting the same 1,200 square feet, mm-hmm. but you get to design it yourself. So you can scan the diorama, and then everybody gets to adjust their own. And mm-hmm. then, yeah, so that's, I mean, there's just a whole different
floor plan. So you can pick your own floor plan.
Exactly. Yeah, so there's like a whole different way. Yeah. Instead of only getting three options, you now have endless options. Like that's just kind of one example of how to utilize or apply scanning right. and AR itself. So, I mean, that was something that I thought was cool because you combine these technologies. And we're always talking about cutting edge tech. Mm-hmm. When you talk cutting edge, you're combining innovative tech already. Mm-hmm. So it's two things: 3D scanning, which we've been kind of doing, but very expensively for a long mm-hmm. time. And then there's construction. We build these houses all mm-hmm. the time. They need to be built really fast. And now we can 3D print the houses. So another aspect in there makes mm-hmm. it more customizable. So I think a 3D scanning is just going to be another tool in our toolkit, like printing would be. You fabricate right. your mm-hmm. own parts and stuff
so,
like that.
So like we were talking Terminator. I mean, we could probably go crazy about what we can do with 3D scanning. Yeah. For me, I think about what I see far as applications. Mm-hmm. I see a kid loses a limb. Mm-hmm. I scan the opposite limb. Because I scan the opposite limb and I use some algorithms, or I use algorithms that account for physics and everything, it makes a mirror of the opposite hand to correspond to this. Now, he has the same hands,
yeah.
and we account for that one hand may be bigger than the other. Mm-hmm. That's just human anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
We're not perfect.
I mean, in it.
So
yeah,
I can see it in that aspect. I can see it in the aspect of I have a person that's going to be a doctor. Instead of operating on cadavers, I can scan a cadaver
mm-hmm.
and print these parts out. And just like we did operation,
mm-hmm.
that person can do operation.
So it's like mm-hmm. reusable dead people?
Yeah,
it's only so many cadavers.
Right.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you think about it, and we brought this up the other day,
yeah.
is the use of 3D scanning in real estate. Matterport has a scanner out now that they use for the 3D home tours that you see mm-hmm. pop up ever since COVID came around.
Yeah.
Ever since, that little thing rolled its ugly head. And I swear you say it three times, it's like Beetlejuice. But, champ.
Yeah. I'm not saying it.
But, the thing is, it's like, 3D scanning, we've seen it, I wouldn't say invade the industry, but it's made the industry a little bit more, I don't know, high tech. Instead of you're walking around with a real estate agent you don't want to listen to, to mm-hmm. walk around, a house, to look at a house you may or may not want,
yeah.
And now you can do it virtually.
Yeah.
And you don't have to listen to nobody,
And to be honest,
nice.
The same thing can be done if I want to see something that's thousands of miles away.
Right.
I have this problem. Can you take the 3D scanner and scan so I can see what's going on?
Yeah.
And now, in real time, I can send this information. Like you said, it can mm-hmm. Those data points can be loaded into a system. And now I can do analysis thousands of miles away
mm-hmm.
without having to physically be at that point.
Think about using it in onboarding. You know, you're using something like the Matterport, for example, and onboarding, where you can scan your facility, and you can give people virtual tours of the facilities they may never go into. Mm-hmm. You know, show them what's there. You know, show them the opportunities that may be behind the door that they work in.
Yeah.
Or, you know, use it to show, you know, like schools and stuff like that, to see if people are interested in coming working for your organization. Because then they see everything. There is no, you got to wait for the tour. Or, hey, we don't offer that unless you get a job here and we'll finally show you what's going on behind the curtain. You know, you're not giving away any trade secrets. Mm-hmm. You're just opening the curtain for people to see exactly what's going on.
Or you give a generic.
Right.
But I got one for Champ.
Oh.
No. It's a good one. What objects that you've encountered in physics exist in theory, but physically do not exist? So it's some mathematical shape, or there's some shape that exists. I can do mathematics and show this shape exists.
Yeah.
But this shape does, you know, like.
The test rag.
I mean, like, I'm saying, like, there are some complex.
Klein bottle?
Yeah.
Just it's some things that exist that are problems in physics that exist. And maybe you can scan some of the things that exist that make up the parts, but you cannot make everything. But maybe if you scan some of the things, now you can add the power of computers and the power of algorithms written by people and the mathematics that's been, and then combine that to actually make this shape on a 3D printer.
Yeah, the Klein bottle is probably the most common example I can think of. The outside surface is the same surface as the inside surface. And that's crazy to even think about because it's in the shape of a bottle. But the only way that you were able to conceptualize that before was drawing it on the chalkboard or something like that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, like I can't remember what I saw it in. It was maybe it was AutoCAD or Autodesk or something like that. But it was very early on. But the like models of Klein bottles hurt your head to even look at. So imagine
if you could make this explode it.
Yeah.
And then have it to where each piece is magnetic.
Yeah, it makes it make sense.
I can build it like building blocks. Or if I don't want to do that, imagine if I could break it into different. I could print it in each of the views that you see in CAD.
Yeah.
I can print it out so that I can see it in top view, bottom view, side view, and so forth. And I can even see it three dimensionally.
Yeah.
Or four dimensionally.
Yeah, see, that's the other piece where I was like, the tetrahedron, or tesseract, is technically a square inside a square, and it's connected. It's crazy to even think about.
Some people print those. It's weird.
Yeah, it's weird. But that's the thing. These are mathematically possible. So, but you don't see them happen in nature very often, or it doesn't get to that.
Or we haven't discovered that connection.
Yeah, we see mostly the Fibonacci sequence, which makes sense. But that's just sequencing and development. It doesn't really define overall like shape of whatever you're.
Here's another one I want to throw at you. I'm gonna get because I got one for the application for you. So I'm gonna be a little bit an assist guy on the next two questions. First to him. The first question, what if I'm an archaeologist or say I'm a person that's studying dinosaurs and is that paleontologist, I'm sorry.
That's also archaeology.
But say I don't have the T-Rex skull.
Yeah.
But I can go scan it.
Yeah.
And now I can take it back to a classroom and print it out. And in every every view I want it in, I can put it in.
Right.
And I can go three-dimensional, four-dimensional, or whatever dimensions I want to go that's possible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That 3D scanning can do now.
Yeah.
So what would be an application? Not what I just said.
Right.
You can touch on that, but what would an application be for you that something, I don't know if it's space or if it's making homes for people, what application would you like to scan and be able to 3D print? If you
That's hard. Yeah.
I mean pick two.
I mean, I would like to McDonald's. I mean, it'd be it's really hard to do, but I would like to print an atom. I mean, that would be interesting.
But we know what it looks like.
right? Conceptually, but like,
but conceptually is all we have right now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're trying. Yeah, no. If we're able to get something on an infinitesimal, like a infinitely small scale, to be able to do that, yes, that's one of the things I would want to look at. I mean, of course, you're right. Space is something that's really cool to me, but something about like scanning the moons and asteroids and stuff like that is cool too. I remember when I was a kid in, I can't remember what grade, fifth or sixth, that was one of our projects, was to study one of the planets or systems or something like that, and I picked Jupiter, and that's what we were looking at. So if I was able to print or scan a Jupiter somehow and print it, that would be pretty cool too. So okay. I mean honestly, they're not, that's not as cool as, I mean, of course, a T-Rex, every kid wants to make a T-Rex, and it's harder to get those things, but like, if I'm thinking about something that's actually, that I can confirm is real, I would probably go with some of the planets and stuff.
Okay, for you, I have two.
Oh boy.
You get two choices, so I'm giving you two questions. So you are former military, and thank you for serving our country.
That's a dreadful question.
So if you were able to scan any weapon from America and any weapon from USSR, Russia, or whatever you want to call it, that's a firearm, what weapon would you scan from each?
It really depends. That's where you...
The thing is what do you define as a weapon?
So I'm saying it's a firearm. If you were going to scan a firearm.
Crew served or non-crew served?
It can be automatic or semi-automatic.
Well, crew served is more than one person.
Well, I'm saying, yeah. If you're printing it, you're not printing it for the form that you're trying to print parts to mass produce to sell to people. You're trying to understand the mechanism inside of each, well, and then do a comparison between each of the mechanisms between both of the, whatever it is from the USA and whatever it is from Russia.
Honestly, you know, the Russian side's a little hard because it's something that the US is well known. You know, you start getting into the automated Kalashnikov, the AK, you know, the system that was designed by, you know, somebody who was never supposed to be a weapons manufacturer.
Engineer?
No, actually, no. He was building cars. And then
backyard engineer.
Right. Mm-hmm. Then he got kind of, you know, brought through the system, and then, you know, he became, you know, who he was. You know, at the time, he was a wounded, you know, service member when, you know, in there. However, if you really want to talk about foreign weapons that most people want to scan, to build, to really understand, to break apart, you're really talking about the German MG42, better known as the Buzzsaw. You know, that's something that you really want to break down, you want to look at, because the thing is, the MG42 is actually one of the longest serving weapons outside the US 50 cal. That's still serving today within the German the German ground forces and the Luftwaffe, you know, to this day, and it's also used by the Dutch and a couple other European countries throughout Europe, because it's still being produced to this day. When you start getting into U.S. based weapons. Or, you know, at least NATO based. You know, the US is pretty much built on weapons that we know that work. You know, you got the AR, you've got, or the, you know, the M4 variant, or the M variant. Then you have the 50 cal, and you have, you know, a couple other ones. You know, you start getting into your piston guns, which, you know, you start really getting into your SCARs, your SCAR heavies, your SCAR lights, you know, ones that are currently being used by, you know, U.S. SOCOM and, you know, those operating forces. You know, you really start getting into the one thing that I think is, you know, if because I already know how it works, that's the problem, is, you know, probably the MADUs. You know, now if you're talking historical, you know, U.S. based weapons, that's when I would go look at and scan one of the battleship cannons, because, you know, they would launch a VW Bug halfway across the Pacific, you know, so, and then you start getting into the M1 Grand. The M1 okay. Grand, for me, is the...
I was waiting before we got to the grandfather.
Is the father of all firearms.
Yeah.
And I think that would be the best one. That one and the MG42, and the reason is they fought on the same battlefield.
So, now here's the...
Unless you're starting like the M1919.
Here's the flip before I get to the second question. And you're in on this. Okay, we know what those instruments of death can do.
Yeah.
If you were able to scan these instruments, how could you transform those instruments into instruments of life?
Well, you mean it by squirt gun?
No. What do those devices do?
Yeah, they take a life.
No, we know that's combustion. That's the action. Combustion.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how can we take that type of mechanism and turn it into something? I'll give you an example. Can we make a Kalashnikov into a pump to pump water for a village? Can we make an M1 Grand? Garand, did I say it wrong? Correct.
Garand.
Okay, thank you. To be used.
Or Garand. Sorry.
To be used as a form of transportation.
I don't know.
Can we take instruments of death and take the simple machines that created them and use physics to turn those into instruments of life? Or is it not possible?
I think for a lot of cases, it's very similar to how we make... I mean, you think of the biplane, you have to spin the rudder. That's just pistons, just like in your car, which in a lot of cases... I mean, I'm surprised you didn't say the 1911, but...
I own a few.
When that gun came out, it was so efficient that... Like, I think a lot of the popularity of the firearms that you chose, Nick, revolve around, for the most part, utility and usage. They can take a beating. Mm-hmm. They can still get the job done, even with a little bit of smut or something like blocking anything.
So keep that thought, because I want you just touched on something. I want you to stay on. I want you to keep your train of thought. I want you to touch on something. What is the difference between a bolt action and a revolver, and just simple mechanics?
Yeah.
Is it the motion?
Double hammer, right?
Is it the motion? So one is maybe linear, and maybe the other one is angular.
No, I think
it depends on how you break it.
I mean, because
down.
The revolver, it advances to the next chamber, right?
Both
of them works on the same
firing pin
mechanism, but I'm saying the delivery system.
Yes,
right.
The delivery systems are different on each one.
It's different, very different.
Right. How you feed different. Instead of What was the word, impingement or something like that? So it's using the compressed gas. So it's the reason I say it's efficient is the shot happens, the air compresses, and that motion of coming back for most guns, not every gun.
Yeah, for automatic, it, for some automatic.
Yeah, it
automatic
helps
rifle,
put that next one in. Mm-hmm. So like honestly, it loops that. It's so perfect in its cyclical. Yeah.
Well, now
motion.
You start getting into a. Especially if you start getting into revolvers, mind you, there has been a revolving rifles before, and this is really going to go down a rabbit hole. You start getting into your Gatlings, you start getting into your M1919s, you start getting into, which M1919 is the utmost thing that shows you how to cool down, how to heat up water, right? You know, high cyclic rate, water jacket, heat water. But when you start getting into a bolt action is a rotating assembly that locks forward. It strips a round off of its internal enclosed magazine, locks the breech, fires manual operation to back open. A revolver...
And it ejects.
It ejects as you rotate because the ejection is actually tied to the bolt itself.
Mm-hmm.
Your revolving mechanism is all built into the trigger. So as you fire... That revolver locks forward, locks back. You release that trigger. That trigger then releases the pin that rotates the cylinder to advance the shot to the next round, next available round. You squeeze the action, depending on if it's double action or single action. If it's double action, hammer falls back, falls forward. Now, if it's a single action, that hammer is already back, falls forward, pops the shot, you release the trigger, it rotates, okay. and move forward.
So I want to bring this out of a rabbit hole up to a squirrel tree. So
I wonder how this can do.
So the squirrel tree part is this. How do we use 3D scanning to scan these type of devices so that people understand the mechanics? We're not worried about what it does with the projectile. We're only worried about, in this particular thing I'm saying, only worried about how we advance the round. How do we use that from taking a life to saving a life by using 3D scanning?
I mean, the example I think about, we use...
Probably the wrong word to ask that question.
Yeah, right. In physics, a lot of the times, we call it a free body diagram. So you take and you think about cross sections of whatever you're working on, right? So in my eyes, I mean, you could scan it and you could take a cross section, but at the end of the day, the scan, depending on if you're utilizing, we looked at it the other day, something using infrared or x-rays, those x-rays are more penetrating, so they can get through that steel and see what's inside the actual model without cutting something open. So that's actually something that's, well, it's very expensive right now to do, but it's something that's probably going to get cheaper at a certain point.
So what if I remove the limitations?
What's that?
Each of the devices are transparent. We're not worried about it because we're not trying to fire around. We're only concerned with the advancement of the round.
Yeah,
so, so if everything was clear and I could see clearly through the device, the question is I've given you a mechanism that's been used for centuries for murder.
Well, I wouldn't say murder.
It's murder. I mean, I'm not saying war is not necessary, but I'm saying when you take another person's life, that's murder.
Self-defense.
Self-defense murder.
Yeah.
Well, let's not get it. That's not the place. That's not what we. It doesn't matter.
That's my break of my house. I'll tell you one thing. It ain't in order.
let's not get stuck on that. The point I'm trying to make is, if we're trying to teach kids or try to teach in service members or trying to teach engineers, hey, here's a device. How can I take this device that was used for one application using 3D scanning to use it for another application? It doesn't have to be used for the same application. If I can use 3D scanning, then I cut down, I'm assuming, some of the necessary mathematics that go into how do I do the mathematics for this to go to that? Because if I scan it, I can get it as a model. If I get it as a model, I can understand the shapes. I understand the shapes. I understand the mathematics. I can start making algorithms.
Well, at that point,
so you're dealing with... So how can we use that in another application?
At that point, you're dealing with, you know, you lost me the entire point in freaking scanning firearms. But the thing is because at that point, if I'm going to scan anything and use it for something to, you know, benefit, you know, something like that, it would be I'd scan motorcycle world. I would use a motorcycle world because the thing is you can create that engine into a heat pump.
But still, back to, it could be a motorcycle, it can be a, it doesn't matter what the thing is. I'm saying, but how do we use the scanning technology to take whatever the technology was and figure out a way? Somebody had to figure out a long time ago that, hey, induction heating can be used for heating up a piece of metal. Oh, how did they get to that? That's all I'm saying. How did the engineering go from this was the only application to here's a new application? That's what I'm asking.
And they also don't have
whether it's a motorcycle, whether it's a IP in a car, whatever it is. How do we take that with scanning and use it to make new technology?
Yeah, you're dealing with a blow apart at that point.
I mean, that's the reason I say a cross section. Like you take the cross section, you take apart, you see whatever's moving. And you see why it moves, and breaking it down and understanding why it's efficient is easier to do or easier to see. We talked about it when we talked about nozzles. I cut the nozzle in half, and I know why it's not like flow rate. The flow rate's low because you've got a weird angle coming to the point here, or you've got a weird you don't have a good quality on the inside surface of your nozzle. So it's abrasive and it's ruining your print material. But at the end of the day, a cross section, and I mean, it's kind of, I guess, burned into your brain in physics is taking a free body diagram, seeing what forces kind of react on what, and then you can see why something moves a certain way. But that doesn't mean you need it to move that way. You can then take that and kind of change.
So why a cone and not a cylinder?
What do you mean?
for an Oscar.
Why? Oh, because we can. We don't want to have. If we have to heat it, well, there's a couple things. If we have to heat it, then we're going to mess with the cellular structure of that material. So if we heat it too small, it's too brittle, too easy. So there's it's a sweet spot. I mean, there's a reason why we went from 2.8 something millimeter nozzle to 1.75. It's more efficient, and your dimensional accuracy is better.
What about viscosity? Is viscosity affected by the opening or how much we heat it?
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because I was talking with a friend the other day who made his own. He built his own computer in the water cooling system, and he was. It's very scary, by the way. Very scary.
Something about water in my computer. I don't really mix.
Don't try it unless you know what you're doing. But there's somebody that he showed me. He showed me a video he thought was funny because he was using it to teach him why things work a certain way. So your technology is almost built to operate at a peak efficiency temperature, right? The viscosity of a liquid changes based on that temperature too. So if you're working with water, and maybe that CPU is burning a little hotter than normal, you get to a closer point where this is probably not cooling as much as you would like it to be. He showed me a video where someone put maple syrup in there, like from the fridge just immediately, and you'd think that's way too viscous. It's way too much.
It works because it heats up.
It heats up. You're right. It's very sticky still, but it works, and it works better than water. Because of the viscosity.
I can explain to you without being a physics person why.
No.
Simple.
It's like gear oil.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why we use oil in the engines and not water. But that's also why we use a chemically treated water or a antifreeze inside of the cooling system.
Unless it's drag applications and you're running water.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was just like.
Makes sense. The chemical composition is affected by the heat that's applied to the chemical composition.
The funny part is when you start dealing with, your fluid inside of an engine, especially like coolant and antifreeze, it's the only fluid that won't crack your engine block if it drops below a certain temperature, because the fact that the antifreeze, when you mix it with water, it cuts the freeze temperature down. That's why coolant doesn't freeze.
And also there are animals that exhibit the same behavior.
Yeah. The oil itself will freeze. That's why if you're in, the North 40 over there, where no one else wants to go.
You get the special oil.
Hello to you guys in North Dakota. You have to run your vehicle 99.9% of the time. It's great. You have diesel engines out there that, they're plugged in throughout the summer, throughout the winter time. They're nice winter coat on, they're all freeze.
At least they got rid of the heat. What was it, the plug? The glow plugs?
Some of them still have them.
But really?
But the thing is, it's if you think about it, it beats the alternative where we have to leave the engine on the entire time to idle through the night or if you turn it off, it'll freeze in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
It's like you start dealing with the stuff in the Arctic. It's like you start dealing with stuff in the Arctic, that's when you really need a 3D scanner, because these guys are way outside of any realm of something being delivered.
Yeah, it's going to be hard.
What I think would be awesome if we could put the...
Well, the thing is, at wintertime, they don't get any planes.
Yeah.
If we could put 3D...
So you're going to make your own.
3D scanners on drones, we should be scanning the Antarctic before the structure changes.
Yeah.
The other thing is you can also anticipate what portions of the Antarctic is going to start falling off into the ocean. Because what happens is that's fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
Fresh water falls in salt water. Now you have a separation in layers.
The brackish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that has an impact on the how the water raises.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. If they can make drone shows with hundreds and thousands of drones to make Santa dance with, Mrs. Claus, then they can do something like that.
I think the use of 3D scanners at this point is not going to go away anytime soon.
Mm.
I think we're just at the epitome of it. I think we've just really started really seeing what we can do. The thing is yes, we are going to see an increase in military operations and stuff like that, military uses for 3D scanners as far as rapid prototyping, how to fix parts.
That's normal.
And stuff like that.
Yes.
We're gonna see the use in, manufacturing, we're gonna see the use in healthcare, we're gonna see the use in damn near everything. The one thing that, we hope to see is the use in education.
because, you know, I hate to say it, but like your shop classes, your automotive classes, your 4-H classes are going away. Slowly but surely, they're being removed from schools. You know, unless you're in certain rural areas where you will see, a 4-H, you will see an auto. Was 4-H
farming?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. FFA if you don't have 4-H.
Right. The after school thing. But like we had
Future Farmers of America.
Yeah, that's what I was in.
We had you know auto. You know where I was at. You know we did have 4-H at one point, and then they got rid of it. And then they used our auto shop class to teach the people who really wanted to learn how to work on the tractors. We didn't have FFA. You know, I think we had the Christian Athletes Association. We didn't have, you know, FFA because no one, you know, at that time.
It's about participants. Yeah.
Right. You know, well, that, you know, Florida, you know, the closest thing we have to farming is orange groves. So, you know, that or saltwater farming, if you think about it, talk about fishing. But, you know, the thing is being able to scan an engine and show kids how the engine works. But like you said, the cutaway diagrams, showing the kids how pistons move and stuff like that with the firing orders of certain V8s, maybe ones that are extinct. You know, as far as you can really teach kids how to work on a flathead V8 that most people don't know how to work on anymore, or the straight 8 that came in the old 35 Buicks, or the straight 6s that came in some of these other motors. You're actually able to show these kids historical engines that were from the time before that they can learn to work on, you know, just by looking at a visual representation of these things. You know, and the same thing about teaching people how to work on transmissions. Not a lot of people understand how an automatic transmission works. Being able to split that apart and showing them, hey, this is how your solenoids work to engage your gears, you know, is another way of keeping those kids involved and engaged. Then you start getting to the 4-H guys. You know, you're teaching them about each and every type of tractor that's out there, giving them the walkthrough, the scan through, you know, what how things work and stuff like that, you know, before they actually go out and utilize one if they don't already have one at home.
Mm-hmm.
Or even using it, like you said, putting a scanner on a drone and sending it over a farm field. To give you an idea of what, you know, and not just to do, you know, checking the crops, but to do terrain mapping and topology, you know, to see what that, you know, that the layers look like that you're dealing with. So you understand, do I need to cut the tops of this off and flatten, or do I spread crop here, and cut over the rest? But the thing is you start dealing with dead drop, you know, and stuff like that, where I can just blow all this stuff out, flatten it out, and off you go. You know, but I think that, you know, when we start seeing scanning and stuff like that, we're going to start seeing scanning pop up in some areas that may not have seen it in the past. We do see people using it to build custom cars, and that's kind of one of the reasons why I bought one, is for automotive restoration, and to build parts that aren't around anymore.
Do it to show engineers how a differential works. Cause,
right, exactly. Most of them don't.
Yeah. Absolutely crazy how they figure that out.
Yeah. So I'll say this. Here's two applications I think we didn't cover, and I don't want to go deep into either one, just to give like a quick. So we use satellites right now to scan the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine if you could do the same thing with drones going over to Amazon, and then you did a triangulation between the two technologies. Where I could verify and then print out in real time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something useful.
Yeah, printable terrain maps.
Before things disappear and we never see them again.
Yeah.
But I think one thing that maybe would be interesting if we were able to put 3D scanning technology into a capsule and a person swallowed the capsule and it did an actual scanning of your internal
your GI organs. Tract, so yeah. That'd definitely be awesome.
And then maybe that's something that you can catch some diseases earlier by using that technology to scan, and then this could be, you know, brought out to something that a doctor could look at and say, oh, okay, now I see this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know we're getting ready to run long, but I'm gonna throw this out there. Because me and him have talked about it a few times. Using 3D scanning to support museums. 3D scanning and augmented reality to support museums.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good idea.
Use it for, you know, it's the way of being able to take artifacts. It's, yeah, I guess you could call it, what is it, like digital artifact storage? Because the thing is some kids don't get a chance to go to a museum.
Hmm.
You know, it's sad, but it's true. You know, some of these kids may never see Neil Armstrong's, you know, flight suit that he took to the moon. You know, they may never see the Apollo 11 capsule that's sitting in the Smithsonian. They may never see a moon rock, you know, that's sitting in the Smithsonian, or even some of the stuff they have. You know, it's giving them the ability to take that, you know, information, send it to a VR or AR type of headset. I know they do have them, you know, because I've seen some of the stuff online, but it's all computer generated. You know, why not give somebody the ability to hold it in their hand and spin it? You know, just by scanning it and throwing it out there. You know, give kids the ability to play, you know, but play to learn. Have them be able to look at things, spin around, and learn exactly what that is. Be able to hold it in their hand, because stuff they may never be able to hold in their hand. You start talking about, you know, ancient artifacts and stuff like that from Egypt. You scan that stuff, and people who may never make it to Egypt to see that type of stuff inside the museums will now be able to see it firsthand, full size. They'll understand the size of that stuff. They'll understand how big the sarcophagus was, you know, of King Tut. You know, you start seeing that type of stuff that people finally will be able to get their hands on and see, but may never go there. And the thing is I really think, and this is where it has a twofold approach, is the fact that I think that if we get people into digital museums like that, where they can play with things and have things in their hands, they're more likely to visit those areas, thereby helping the economy grow. Mm-hmm.
I think you can go one step further than that. I think you can go holograms. If I'm able to 3D scan, I can take mirrors and lenses and so forth and make holograms. So I can even get away from or with the headset. Mm-hmm. I can use holograms in conjunction with the headset, or I could not even have to have a headset and have a hologram that does whatever it does based on how I interact with it, because when I enter this field, I'm changing the dynamics of that field, and it feels like I'm doing whatever. I can blow air on the people's hands. We can take some lessons from Disney, and it feels like they have a Hope Diamond in their hand. You know, I can make cold air, or I can make it feel like it's a rough texture, you know. So maybe those are things you can do also in conjunction with augmented reality to get the holodeck.
Yeah. If you think about it, you can have all of these headsets be sitting in the libraries of schools. You have a museum day. You go to the library, all the kids put on a headset, they're guided walkthrough of a museum that they chose that day. Oh, I'm working on ancient Egypt. Okay, cool. We're going to walk you through that museum real quick.
Yeah, I'd say honestly that'd be cheaper than making a whole room for everybody, like a classroom. Mm-hmm. But I think doing like a Magic School Bus classroom would be pretty cool.
Yeah,
sit everybody on a bus.
But nah, they don't have to get on the Magic School Bus.
But they could virtually.
It's the lessons.
They could virtually.
Yeah,
I agree, but if you're walking into a bus and then that, like, they're while they're preparing the thing, that would be a little bit immersive. So I think that would be cool. But honestly,
all the lessons they had.
Maybe not. But seriously, that's the idea, though. That's what you're getting at. So, I mean, to me, like, it makes sense.
Yeah, it's just one other way of, you know, not just helping the people, but helping the economy that comes about it, you know?
Yeah. Like I said, for me, I think we're getting close to ending. For me, the thing I see about the scanning is it's another tool to allow us to advance our knowledge, however we use it. You know, whether it's used for defense or it's used for aeronautics or if it's used for mapping the ocean floor or if it's used for looking at a organism that's cancerous so we can pull it apart and see how the inner workings of this thing work in a macro environment instead of a microscopic environment so that people can better understand it. I think those are probably good things that would, you know, or, hey, maybe we're trying to understand how an asteroid or a body that's an asteroid is affected by things in space. You know, maybe we want to get an exact scan that asteroid all the way around so we can make an exact model. You know, so maybe those are some things that you could do.
Yeah. You know, bring them to the moon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. You know, especially with the new Artemis Accords going on. We don't know what we're going to find.
Or we can put a probe that has 3D scanners.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, can we make sure we land upright this time first? You know, on the moon, and let's make sure.
It's on the dark side, so it's hard to see.
I don't mean putting a stationary probe. I mean the same thing we did when we were checking out the universe, when we discovered things about
like Jupiter, the Parker Solar Probe,
Pluto.
Oh, it's still flying, so you're good.
So you know that would be awesome if we had. I would say maybe two in tandem.
That's I mean that's what I'm saying, and I'm gonna go ahead into my goodbye right after this because I wanna. This will be the last thing I'll say on it. But the Parker Solar Probe, the way that they did their boosting and their boost back and their continuous, they've made one trip where we thought about just going to the sun and back or around the sun, right? Mm. That's it took it from 50 working hours of data. And what they're doing now is they're calling it, they were using Jupiter's orbit to help control their orbit, right?
Yeah, sling it.
And sling it back and forth, but they wouldn't get as much time out of it. Right now, they're using Venus instead, and it's a much faster iteration. So they're getting over 600 hours of working information and data. So to me, it makes sense. If I have an asteroid, it's a little bit harder because that asteroid's gravity is so little.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to make it so much smaller and smaller. But if we have a moon or something like that, or like a planet that we want to scan, I absolutely think send 3 or 4 scanners out there, put it in the orbit of the planet like we do the satellites here. You've got that. You've got everything you need.
And maybe even this. How about we send scanners opposite ways?
Hmm.
So we send scanners towards the sun. We send scanners toward the end of the universe. We send scanners, you know, to the just to see that if we send to, just say if it's 4 corners, we know it's not. Please,
just saying,
please don't kill us. I'm not saying there's 4 corners in the universe.
It's a flat earther.
Yeah. Yeah. So, say if there was 4 orbit patterns to the universe.
Mm-hmm.
If we had 4 orbit patterns for 4 different scanners, mm-hmm. and data was able to be collected from 4 different scanners, and 4 said scanners, data was able to be collected, and then we can make the ultimate scanner. Maybe that's something cool.
You're onto something. We don't want to keep going to. We can make space a whole conversation, but there's something called Lagrangian points.
Mm-hmm.
Lagrangian points are the points of orbit that are most that where 2 orbits may create like a stable region, and that's what you should probably. Yeah, that was what you would want to use.
Yeah, that's where you have the what is it, Hubble, and Hubble's in one, and
James Webb
is in the other.
Yeah. So, it's. That was my favorite part of physics was the Lagrangians.
Yeah.
And it's where you can isolate points of motion and say, well, even though everything is moving like crazy over here, they all work in unison in this one spot, and it's equilibrium right there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really
It's kind of, and I know we're getting ready to go over, but
we can,
it is what it is. But, you know, it's very hard to pinpoint that location. Once they pinpoint it, the boost burn to there, making sure you don't float through it is, you know, always fun because you start talking about trying to reverse in space. Things get a little weird, you know, because things aren't designed to go in reverse, you know, that much in space. Once you hit that point, you're stuck there. You're just floating.
Well, the reason for that is you're going so fast to be going in an orbit in one direction.
Yeah.
To slow down. You need to go the opposite way, twice as hard, pretty much, just to even get some.
And you're limited by the speed you're going in.
And that's just
going
to stop you in place. Mm. You got to keep going further just to go backwards.
Yeah, there's a whole lesson we can do
on
you know, atmospheric fun as far as when you start talking about, you know, cold gas engines and, you know, reentry methods when you're coming back into orbit, which could be an interesting fun part. We just saw that with the last freaking Starship that went up.
Yeah.
By the way, you cannot do front flips and side flips to be able to come down into Earth orbit, and it will not work. But we'll get on that later.
You will not equilibrate.
No, you usually go to pieces. Yeah. But, you know, I think that brings us to the end. You know, I want to say thank you to everybody who, you know, has taken the time, you know, to listen to us and, you know, get involved with what we're saying. You know, and, you know, half the time we say this because we're having fun with it. You know, we want people to have a good time. You'll hear us arguing about things, but, you know, we're having fun about it. You know, no one's really arguing about anything at this point. But, you know, looking at the stats, we had 2,283 people listen to us so far. You know, y'all are freaking, you know, killing it here. And you know, we keep wanting to get more and more and more. We want to get y'all more involved. You know, if you're on the, and I see some of y'all from different countries that we haven't seen in a long time. You know, if y'all are on YouTube, or if you're on, you know, some of the websites, or if you're on, you know, what is it, X, Instagram, Facebook, or whatever, ping us. Say hello. Let us know what you're thinking about. Let us know what you are wanting to learn. You know, like, comment, subscribe on the videos that we got going on Facebook, and I swear we'll add more. I promise. More shorts are coming. I got a couple more I got to upload. You'll also see us eventually do a review of the Revo Point Morocco, you know, probably in the next couple weeks. And, you know, we will be bringing you somewhat coverage from the shows going on up in Chicago this year, from Automate, but you know, we'll get to that at a later date. So I just want to say thank you. You know, go check out all the other stuff that we got in the links, and I'll turn it over to the guys. Y'all have a good one.
I'd just like to say thank you guys for supporting us. I'm glad to be back. Life happens sometimes, so you know, things happen, but it was a nice conversation this week. Really enjoyed the topic. We are a little off of the original topic, but I think sometimes that's necessary.
Yeah. And so I'm always appreciative, and I did echo what these guys have to say. Of course, it's always nice to have a platform to kind of speak on and spread some of the knowledge. If some people are interested, then that's, you know, that's exactly what we're trying to do. If you learn something, that's what we're looking for. I want to challenge everybody listening. Why is the speed of light the upper limit of the universe? And why have we not gotten anything to go to the speed of light? So I'm not going to go into any answer or any explanation, but we could probably talk about it on next episode or something like that, or whichever episode makes sense. But reach out to us if you know. If we get the right answer, we might think about doing some type of prize or something like that. See, get some involvement from you guys. So, if you got any other questions that you'd like to ask us, reach out as well. And yeah, listen, keep track of Printed Heritage,
yep.
Volcanara, check out the blog, and stay tuned, guys.
And by the way, if you get the question right, Champ will serenade you in Ray of Light.
Wait, you didn't have to tell him what I was going to do.
All right, y'all have a good one. All right, bye. That's all for this episode of Tech at Lunch. Thanks for tuning in and joining us for this tech-filled lunch break. We hope you enjoy the show, and don't forget to subscribe on all channels. And also, you can find us on YouTube under Volcanara Technology Solutions. And join us for our next episode, which gets published every Wednesday at 8 a.m. All right, y'all. Have a good one. See you later.